Welcome to New York Zen Center for Contemplative Care's podcast. This free podcast is made possible through your generosity. Please consider making a donation through our Ways to Give link on zencare.org.
Is anyone tired? Raise your hands if you're tired. So I'll try to keep this under 90 minutes. Wow, what an incredible day so far. It's amazing how, I think as Koshin and both Diane have said, how our preferences arise when we come on retreat, when we see the things that we like, annoy us, like this thing, the things that we don't like, how we would like things to be different to what they are, and so what? This is the way that it is. And can you be fully available to what is arising? Sometimes enjoyable, and sometimes not quite so much. The Dharma presenting itself nonstop. Just be with it. Shanti Davis said, "No evil is there similar to anger, no austerity to be compared with patience. Steep yourself, therefore, in patience, in various ways, insistently." Patience. So that's what I'll talk about a little bit this evening. The phrase, "all things come to those who wait," was actually coined by a Victorian novelist poet named Violet Fane. She lived a very grand life, married to a couple of dukes, and wrote a bunch of stuff. But she coined that phrase. All things come to those who wait. Extolling the virtue of patience. This idea of waiting has been coined in pop culture. In the UK, where I'm from, "the good things come to those who wait" was used in the ad campaign for Guinness. You know, so the guy would be standing at the bar and everybody else is getting their drinks. The big Irish guy's just standing there, waiting. You know, smile on his face. And then comes the pint of Guinness. And then picks up the glass. Here in America, they use the same phrase for Heinz tomato ketchup. Ew. Not quite as classy as Guinness. Good things come to those who wait. And then there is, "revenge is a dessert best served cold." Has anyone not heard that one before? Really, Richard? Wow. Revenge is a dessert best served cold. So it's not sure where that phrase originated, but it means the revenge is best served not fresh, but after the insult has occurred, to wait a while until enough time has passed that the perpetrator doesn't see it coming. The Japanese are really good at this. They can wait 1,000 years before striking. Right? They can just hang out. I'm thinking this is not what Shantideva had in mind when he wrote this stanza. And this, patience is a virtue. This is a proverbial phrase relating to one of the seven heavenly virtues, as opposed to the seven deadly sins. The seven heavenly virtues, which are said to date back to the Psychomachia, which is an epic poem written sometime in the 5th century. So the plot consists of the personified virtues of humility, kindness, abstinence, chastity, patience, liberality, freedom. In the poem, it's I think it's said to be less than 1,000 lines. This is just a couple of examples here. Chastity is assaulted by lust. By the way, the personifications are all women in this poem, for whatever reason. I Googled this, so it's not that I'm that smart. But it has something to do with the fact that abstract personifications were given the gender of feminine in Latin. So all the personifications were female. So chastity is assaulted by lust, but cuts down her enemy with a sword. Greed is portrayed against love, but is unable to obtain what it cannot coexist with. Greed and love. Anger attacks patience, but cannot defeat or even injure her. Driven mad with frustration, anger ultimately kills herself instead. Amazing. Does it make you want to run out and buy Psychomachia? Or download it? So patience, I'm afraid, is not one of my virtues. And some of you may have experienced my impatience from time to time. When my patience is absent, I'm either in anxiety, anger, or fear. I don't know why, but waiting for an elevator fills me with anxiety. It's not impatience. It's anxiety. I feel something really kind of churning inside and start to like move around, and it's a very different feeling to impatience. When I'm waiting in line in Starbucks, it's a different experience. When there seems to be no good reason why, with 5 baristas, 3 of them are putting things away, 1 of them is counting the money, and the only one seemingly concerned about the customers is dispensing skinny chili lattes with Madagascar cinnamon and soy milk or mocha whatevers. And I just want my espresso. So all I want is a simple espresso. By the time I get out of Starbucks, my adrenaline is pumped so high, the last thing I need is caffeine. But I have gotten to such a pitch of anger, just seeing how things are not working quite the way I would do it. You know, being an ex-maitre d', and seeing how things should move in the service world, should we say, really gets me crazy. So that's my anxiety, my anger. The fear comes from a very different place. It's from my small child place. It comes from the place of not knowing what the hell is going on. It doesn't come from the not knowing we talk about in practice. It's a very different not knowing. It's like, I don't know what's happening. It's the not knowing of where will I be living next and with who as this small child. And is my mom going to come home? And if so, when? It's a very scary place, this I don't know. So if I'm left hanging, waiting in a restaurant, or at the corner of the street where we have arranged to meet at, say, 8 o'clock, and it's 8:10, I start to get really scared. And then I get really, really scared. And then I get out of control, basically, and I have to leave. It's like, you know what? I'm gone, because I can't stay in it. So when I'm with Koshin, even if I'm with Koshin and we're waiting for people, I'm like, all right, we're going. 15 minutes. It's all about this fear of they're not going to come. You know? So I have to run first. So I'm not going to left. I'm not going to be left alone. I'm going to run first. I'm going to run from that fear. So what I want to talk about this evening is what happens for me doing this work of caregiving, being with others. So there's a koan that I love to use, and I've overused it, because every time I come to a garrison for this retreat at this time of the year, I'm reminded of the koan. As we drove up yesterday, Susan and I, we were really in awe of the leaves, the colors. Changing of the leaves. Did anybody else drive up and notice the leaves? It was amazing, magnificent. And so every time we're here at this month in at Garrison, it's always just so beautiful. So this koan is about the leaves, the autumn. And koans change or rather we change when working with these particular stories. So the first time I worked with this koan, it was a very different understanding or appreciation of it. And this time, it's a brand new appreciation of this koan. It goes like this. A monk asked Yunmen, how is it when the tree withers and the leaves fall? How is it when the tree withers and the leaves fall? Yunmen replied, body exposed in the golden wind. Body exposed in the golden wind. So that's the koan. So what's the monk really asking here? Remember, these koans are always a dialogue between the Zen master and the student or the monk. And the student can be testing the master's knowledge of the great matter of Zen, or the master will throw it back or ask a question and see what the student's understanding is. So here, the monk is asking, what happens when you let go of concepts and ideas? What is the practice of not being attached to results or outcome, to this opinion or the truth? When we let go and let go and let go, now what? Okay? What happens when the tree withers and the leaves fall? And Yunmen responds, body exposed in the golden wind, full exposure, as though we're naked in the winds of life, letting everything in and everything out. It's a little bit another way to look at this poem. I mean, there are many ways to look at this koan, but it's a little like those of us who are aging. I feel like I'm aging now in my sixth decade. And the tree is withering and the leaves are falling as, you know, certain aspects of my body are changing. You know, not spending so much time in the gym, not being able to do certain things anymore, lifting much less weight. And the tree is withering. The body is changing. And I can hang on to all those leaves as though that's going to help. I can compare and despair in the gym, which I did for a long time. You know, why don't I have that body anymore? Well, because I'm not 30 or 35 or 40. Or I can look in the mirror and say, that's what I got. Which is not easy for me, actually. But it's what I got. The leaves are falling. Everything is changing. Some of you know I'm going through this. Talk about leaves are falling. My teeth are falling out of my face. I have this huge gap here now. I went to get my bridge replaced a couple of weeks ago, and it's like, nah, implants. So, you know, my teeth are falling out. Body's changing. Leaves are falling. Teeth are falling out of my head. Body exposed to the golden wind. So how is it when we're vulnerable, when we really allow ourselves to see that this is part of our condition, to let the leaves fall to the ground in different situations? So when I walk into a room or make a visit to someone's home, I'm fully there, stripped bare of my stories, my fears and anxiety, the leaves of insecurity have been tossed in the wind. When I allow myself to be vulnerable, I'm given the person in front of me, or the family members, the opportunity to do the same. If I'm showing, as Dan mentioned this afternoon, if I'm being fully authentic of who I am, there's an opportunity for whoever I'm with to also be fully authentic, because we're connecting on that level. Or not. You know, it's not like, well, here I am, all vulnerable and authentic, and you should be the same. No. They might say, get out. I don't want your vulnerability. Wait to get out. Might be too much. When it happens, it's really beautiful when we make that connection with someone on whatever level it is. For me, if the patient or the person that I'm visiting with is in a fearful state, it's really comfortable for me because I have that familiarity with fear. So I can sit in my place, can stand my ground. I can stay there with them in their fear, in their anxieties, in their anger. And it's not that I've done all this amazing work and I'm in some, reach some state of enlightenment. In fact, as I said this morning, when Koshin and I were doing that exercise, you know, how does your fear impact your ability to be fully in relationship? I froze, you know, went into dissociation. Couldn't be there with the person I'm most intimate with in my life. Couldn't go there. Too frightening. So I'm fully cognizant of the fact that my mind, after all these years of practice, is still running the show most of the time. Right? Still, that stuff comes up, and boom, I am off. So I think my work in my Zen practice, for me anyway, and we all have our different traditions and our different practices, is to realize that I'll never be fully free of these hindrances. I'll never be fully free of these demons for me. But they don't have to loom quite so large. If I practice diligently to be present, use that word again, present, to everything that's arising, and understand that it's my conditioning. This is my conditioning in this life. This was what I was given from this big to this big, from this little tiny sapling to this withering tree. Right? It's actually done quite well, this tree. Big, strong oak or something. British oak. I don't know. There used to be a pub called the British Oak on the corner of our street. That's where I used to go and fetch my mom. If ever she was like MIA, she was in the British Oak, singing songs at the end of the piano with a glass of beer. It's funny how things come back into your mind, right? The British Oak, and there it is. My immediate, what's that word I'm looking for? Association with a pub. Mind you, there's a pub on every street corner in England anyway. But, and there's probably more than one British Oak. But there's only one that my mum found, as far as I know. So to be present to all that's arising and to understand that this is my conditioning. I fall down 7 times and get up 8. I can't stay down. I actually spent a long time staying down. And then one day I decided to get back up. 8th time. Shinryu Suzuki said, even in our imperfect practice, enlightenment is there. We just don't know it. So the point is to find the true meaning of practice before we attain enlightenment. Wherever you are, enlightenment is there. If you stand up right where you are, right now, if you stand up, enlightenment is there. Dogen, the founder of Soto Zen, said that simply sitting zazen, simply sitting on the cushion is enlightenment. We don't have to go searching for anything. It's right here. It's amazing to think, I always, to be sitting in this incredible space right now, this monastery, this hall, and to think of enlightenment in this context, this Buddhist context. However we see enlightenment, whatever we think it is. And I often get a giggle when I see this big Buddha behind me, standing in front of, sitting in front of all these pews. And we happened to have met one of the last monks that was living here when we first, the first time we came to Garrison. It's really, really, and ironically, this really, really nice guy, one of the last Capuchin monks, who was a Zen practitioner. Turned to Zen. And now he's a chaplain living in Cape Cod. And he told us all the stories about the ghosts in this building. For those of you who've heard the footsteps in the hallways. So, it's a little history there. So, that's what I got. That's all I got. Me and the big yellow Buddha behind me. So all you Buddhas out there searching for enlightenment, you've already got it. Just sitting on your cushion, it's already here. You just have to let go of the idea that you're looking or that you have it.